Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We are coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Marlene Even. How has the Australian population changed over the years? Have many Australians moved to regional areas? Where have rent prices soared? And how many of us speak another language? Yes, you guessed it, I'm talking about the newly released 2021 census. This week, journalists have been reporting on the intriguing snapshot of Australia with critical analysis and infographics to boot. There are many stories to be told within the data of the census, and that data can be presented in interactive and beautiful ways. We've seen a lot of data-driven journalism in the media in recent years, from crunching the election numbers to census maps to the COVID-19 curve. This week, we're chatting with data journalists about the changes in their industry and the craft of communicating complex data with their audiences. To answer all this and more, we are joined by Juliet O'Brien, a data and digital journalist and author. Juliet created the website covid19data.com.au, tracking the transmission of COVID-19 in Australia. Juliet, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Thanks for having me.
And we are also joined by Nick Evershed, the data and interactives editor at Guardian Australia. Welcome, Nick.
Hey.
And Wes Mountain, the multimedia editor at The Conversation. He is an illustrator, cartoonist and writer. Welcome to Fourth Estate.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Now, the Australian census, I'm imagining, is like data journalists' Christmas Day. So in preparation of this release, are you looking at data with a story or idea already in mind? Or how do you go about sourcing a story from the census?
Yeah, I mean, I can answer that. I just got to say from the get-go, though, like, the census is like in equal parts amazing, but also very frustrating because you don't actually get the best access to data on day one, which is incredibly frustrating because that's when the most attention is on it and when all the headlines are written. So we won't get like the best information about census data until Table Builder actually comes out and the associated functionality that comes out at the same time. And that's when you can actually not just look at, you know, the number of people in an area, but also look at, of those people, you know, how many had a high school education and were also male or female and X, Y, and Z. So when that comes out, you can actually do cross-tabulation, which we can't right now. So what we have right now is great and interesting, but for the most part, it's kind of like incremental change on long-term trends. And then, of course, because it was done in the middle of a pandemic, there's that aspect to it as well. And that's probably the most interesting thing this time around, is to see how the middle of the pandemic differs from 2016. So that was kind of like our first thoughts when we were preparing for the data release, was like, you know, looking at tree changes, people getting out of the cities, looking at income, that sort of stuff that might have been affected by, you know, all of the things that happened in the pandemic, I guess.
Yeah, if I might jump in about that as well, for how we looked at it at The Conversation, it's obviously it's a similar issue to what Nick was talking about, in that a lot of the people that we would get to speak on, you know, to write on these as academic experts, are waiting for those bigger drops where they can actually do the kind of, you know, interesting demographic changes in specific areas, or, you know, areas that they've done long-term research in, which is the same thing that happens with Hilda data as well. You know, the drop on day one is super interesting, and as Nick was saying, is when everybody is super interested in it, but the really interesting stuff comes out gradually over time. And you know, we had someone commenting, there's also a kind of a way in which people can be wondering why we're not looking at the right data on day one. So we had someone commenting saying, you know, why are you not telling us about all of the genders of people who have filled out the census? And we can't, because they don't have that question as part of the census. And this is the time when people who might not otherwise be interested in big data are briefly for a really short period of time. And it'd be nice to be not so controlled by how constrained the data is initially.
One other example is I had a colleague of mine ask me where the homeless statistics were, because there is a very good data set which comes out called Estimating Homelessness in Australia based on census data, but it actually won't be out until 2023, I think, based on the ABS website. So, yes, it'll be quite some time before we see some specific things, I guess.
So definitely the spotlight is on now, but all the hard work is coming up in the future. Now, while we've got the spotlight on big data and analysing it, Juliet, I'd like to go to you to discuss your website that you created, covid19data.com.au. So when you created this website and it presents the latest COVID cases and transmissions, can you tell us about how it started and why you created this to begin with?
Sure. It's really interesting, you know, what Nick and Wes were just saying about how fleeting attention can be. And that's what happens with COVID. And that's the reason why I ended up in this position, which was that the problem with data is this intersection between, you need the intersection between people's attention and the actual data. And that's the time when you can kind of catch the wave and actually get into people's kind of heads and everything. And so that's what I ended up doing with COVID, except the wave lasted 2 years and I was not expecting it to last that long when I started it. So I was in the newsroom at the Herald, desk editor on the breaking news desk for that particular shift, and wanted to put a little chart in a story when we had about 40 cases across Australia, and the chart didn't exist. And the data didn't really, well, the historical data didn't exist. I think every night the federal government would update their snapshot page. So, you know, to get that nice line, you had to keep track of the cases yourself. So I started doing it, and I had this gorgeous little Google Doc spreadsheet, and I was tracking every single case line by line. And it was like female, 40s, overseas acquired from, you know, wherever. And that was actually handy, because that then showed that at that time, and this was why it sort of went viral on Twitter, it was the first time that it showed that we still have borders open to the US, but most cases had come in from the US. So that's really how it started. I intended to do it for and with the Herald. So it was set up in the infrastructure that the Herald was using at the time, so into Infograms, and that was nice because it's just a live infogram updates every few seconds. So as the Google Docs spreadsheet was updated, the charts could be embedded all over the place and updated. But then, you know, it was kind of fairly assessed that if with exponential growth of cases comes exponential growth of a Google Docs spreadsheet and also workload of a casual. So I chucked it on a Wix site and shared it with 500 Twitter followers on the same weekend that Scott Morrison was encouraging people to go see the Sharks, and then it went viral. And then, you know, I turned 2 years older. I woke up and, you know, that was 2 years had gone. But look, you know, there were some pretty huge lessons in all of it. And I guess one is this issue of not waiting for the sort of official source to come through with the goods, which is essentially what my editors wanted to do at first. They were waiting for our own version of Johns Hopkins. And so it's also this question of, what do you do when you've got imperfect data, or and do you let that stop you from covering the story, or do you just try to tackle it anyway and, you know, trust that you can communicate the caveats to people.
And I mean, that's a great question of like, what do you do when you don't have that imperfect data, or when that it's still being accumulated and it's still being analyzed? Do you still use it, and then do you communicate to your audience, like, we've got this data, here are the issues, this is what you should keep in mind? Nick, what's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, like, we've had a few projects over the years that have relied on, I guess, you know, trying to get around this problem of there not being an official data set for something that, you know, arguably maybe there should be. And yeah, like Juliet found, then often you just need to get out there and do it yourself, because no one else is going to do it necessarily. So, I mean, we've had situations like that with deaths in custody, for example. We maintained a deaths in custody database for a long time, which we're now doing in partnership with Jumbana at UTS. But, and then similar things with, you know, a few other projects over the years as well. And, you know, if you wait for the government to do it, or if you wait for a research group to do it, it might not necessarily happen. So if you want to do the story, sometimes you just have to spend a long, long time doing it yourself with some help, of course.
I reckon Nick and The Guardian are like leaders in that way. Like I saw someone in the state say the most powerful data journalism they've ever done was counting, literally just counting, right? Like nothing, no crazy sort of modeling or anything. If you can just count stuff, like, for instance, gun deaths or something, that's powerful. And yeah, like The Guardian is doing that interesting tracking of deaths in custody and so on, which I think is really, it shines a sustained spotlight on the issue.
Yeah, I know it's definitely an issue in the US as well with shootings. At one point there was like multiple media databases of police shootings, but no official database. It's like Washington Post, I think, and Guardian US both had them for quite a while. Because they would maintain it federally.
That word tracking, I reckon I see that more and more. Like, we're tracking this and we're tracking that. I reckon that's where it's at.
And with the work you guys have done with the deaths in custody stuff, I think the thing that's so powerful about that is the stories side of it as much as anything. You know, it's about counting, but it's also about making sure that the stories are there and personalizing it. Obviously, you know that, but it, as an outsider consumer, you know, that adds so much. It's a different picture for us at The Conversation, because we're often dealing with academic sources. We're often dealing with government-based sources. There are few occasions where we've been chasing up stuff ourselves or relating to big, I suppose, similar to that problem of the locally reported gun death stuff in the US, where we're pulling together different data sources to kind of pull them together and make that comparison. But it's rare that we're dealing with actually kind of going out and getting data ourselves. It's something we try and do more and more, and look more and more to academics who have interesting data sources or data resources that they are not yet necessarily telling everyone about.
There's so much hidden data in academia. It's it's a huge resource, and there's still a very I don't know what the word is. People don't want to share it necessarily, because it's you're guaranteed to getting publications and you're incentivized to publish and all this sort of stuff. So, yeah, I sympathize. I used to work in the area, and it's like, it can be very tricky collaborating until you've got like an agreement ironed out and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, I will say that there's, obviously there's legal issues and stuff around things like that. But also, and if any any academics are out there listening to this, that much like everything in academia, there's often stuff that is super interesting to lay audiences that academics are holding on to because they think it's boring. and that's as true of data as about almost as a lot of other stories. If there are academics listening, sitting on a great data set, we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, just chuck it up on GitHub.
Yeah, iron out your legal side first, but yeah.
And when you're talking about collating all that data and there not necessarily being an official source you can go to, what's the part you play when questioning if it's trustworthy, like where the data is coming from, what methodology was used to get it. Do you have a sort of checklist that you go through before you decide to use it within a story?
I mean, it depends on the data. Like with deaths in custody, we were relying on coronial inquest documents mostly. So that was mostly pretty straightforward. Some of the media reporting was trickier. All the very recent deaths are always reported in the media before there's an inquest, obviously. So that can be harder. And then it's just making an editorial assessment, much like you would with a normal news story, I guess, and just weighing up what detail is reliable and what should be included for editorial reasons and all that sort of stuff. But I mean, other projects, it's a bit more straightforward. Like we did this one counting pork barreling, or like election spending, I guess. You can't call it all of it pork barreling necessarily, but election campaign promises, let's just call it that, during the election. And that was straightforward. That was just like, you know, if someone makes a promise, we write it down and then we put some details around it in our big spreadsheet. But yeah, I imagine Juliet might have had some issues with the early deaths stuff coming from the media sources and all that sort of thing.
Oh God, totally. Well, in terms of tracking things, like one thing is to say, what I said at the start was, we bring together the fragments of data and information that are technically but maybe not practically available, right? So you're not promising that it's a totally comprehensive, complete data set. You're saying this is, we're bringing together what's out there, so it's a different sort of promise. So that's one way to do it. But yeah, like one thing, for instance, with COVID data at the moment is you do get to a point where the veracity of the data is just sort of undermining the project. So it's kind of like, at what stage, you know, is even reporting cases connected with reality at all, you know, and therefore the different sorts of analyses you want to do from there, like the big one is the hospitalization rate. And that was always the really challenging one, I felt, because that was always the important one, because that led to this question of whether or not the health system would be overrun. And at the start of the Delta outbreak in Sydney, the hospitalization rate was high. It was like 14%. But we didn't know that in the time. We knew that maybe 6 or 8 weeks later from the New South Wales Health Surveillance reports. But there were all of these issues with how many cases are there really? How many people are actually going to hospital? What sort of lag timeframe do you want to use to calculate the hospitalization rate? And I tried asking heaps of experts and never really got a particularly clear answer. It was just like factor in a bit of a lag. But all of these sorts of denominators and numerators that shift around, yeah, like I think that's the big sort of issue, is always asking, just kind of critically questioning the data itself, because, and you know, Mona Chalabi, in the US, she kind of makes this point that because people see data and it's numbers made by a computer, people think it's facts, like it's the truth, when actually there are all of these different issues embedded in it, biases, humans, all of this. And that's one reason why she likes to do the illustrations.
Yeah. And like the international comparisons was and is still a huge issue, because totally. I mean, some countries have been accused of basically faking data. Other countries aren't faking it, but they're using like radically different testing regimes and like ways of counting it and all this stuff. So, but you know, you get aggregating websites that put all these numbers together and put them side by side with not necessarily all that information in place. And then you get people comparing these countries and going, why is this one so great? Why aren't we better? Et cetera, et cetera. But you don't really know what's going on and if it's a good comparison and all this sort of stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And that happened just recently, you know, with this issue of Australia has the most cases in the world. It's like, I don't think so, right? Like it's like when the we're one of the only countries still offering free PCR, you know, mandatory reporting of rats. But that in itself is an interesting tracking project. But you can see how you move from the quantitative to the qualitative pretty quickly, right? Like it would be nice just to have a list of how the countries are reporting testing. I'm sure it's somewhere.
And moving to the data visualization and how you present that data to your audiences, Wes, you create infographics, animations, even cartoons to explain really complex topics. How do you decide when a story would benefit from a visualization, and how do you go about deciding how to present that data?
That's a really good question, and it really depends on what the topic is. I think probably like everyone here and probably all journalists, it does depend sometimes on personal interest. It depends on whether something would work when it comes to illustration or something like that, would work abstractly in a way that would be best served by that. So for instance, even last week we had one as our, various electricity grids are collapsing. We had just a really simple kind of illustrated, this is what the grid is. When you're talking about the grid, something like that's really, it's not really data journalism in that case, it's just explanatory. The one that comes to mind is something a bit interesting and out of the box is we did a comic on lone actor terrorism based on a report out of Europe. And ultimately it was a work, I didn't necessarily immediately think about it this way, but ultimately it was kind of data visualization. It broke down kind of what the most likely picture of a terrorist in Europe during a certain period was likely to be, how to address it, what the background was, et cetera, to cut a long story short, it's probably going to be a right-wing white terrorist, not what people generally assume when they think of a lone actor terrorist. So that one was like a little bit outside of the box. It all depends on time as much as anything else. If it's going to be a short period of time, and I think that's probably true of all of us here, it's going to probably be a chart, and it's going to be super, super simple and quick, and follow our style guides and get out there quickly. If it's going to be something a bit more long-term and actually about visual storytelling, and have to get a whole bunch of data, some of which nobody will, like only one person will ever be specifically interested in, which is a hard thing. Things that hide behind tooltips, or you need to click expand an accordion or something like that to find. Maybe only a really small percentage of the audience will go there, but they should be able to find it if you've got that data. So we did a big project last year called Flora Fauna Fire, year before last, about the bushfires. It has been a weird long 2 years. The recovery from the bushfires. And it both took in the extent of the fire path and where most of Australia's endangered animals were, to show, it was massive overlap. And then the 119 species that the government panel had broken down. And we actually did additional work getting people to do 119 analyses of each of these specific species, and then map each of where their actual habitats were. There's a lot of Galaxias fish, if you're interested. They all look exactly the same, but they're very different. And that one necessarily had to be kind of a large storytelling project. And it paid off, but, I think sometimes you make decisions based on where it's worth putting the labour, what's important. And those are what really drives the decisions. If you've got something that's perfect and it just is going to work so well as a simple animation, like 800,000 years of climate data was an animation and we did, it just is going to sing out to you. But other things are driven by importance as much as anything as far as we're concerned.
And you mentioned there the work, kind of choosing a project depending on how much time you can give it or like how much time you can give to specific projects. What impact does that workload pressure, or in some cases economic pressure, have on your ability to take on projects, on data journalism projects? Juliet, you mentioned before that you have this website that you wanted to create but didn't have the space, I guess, so you've created it on your own. Could you tell us a bit about what impacts that workload and economic pressure can have?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, it started because the newsroom couldn't support it, couldn't support that work of manually tracking the cases. And so that's why volunteers ended up doing it. And, you know, thank God for people like Wes and Nick who would use it and acknowledge it. And that sort of helped to give the different sites, and COVID-19 data is not the only one by any stretch, but we all kind of, we earned people's trust. And I guess what happened was, I mean, in my case, the public funded it. So as soon as like a quarter of a million sort of people visited the site on a weekend, I was like, oh, Jesus, I better put some ads on this or something. And then I couldn't because it's all iframes. And so I put a donate button on and people scrolled to the bottom of that website and donated. Like, people are incredible. And so that locked me in for the long term. So there was a hunger for it and then people funded it. You could say COVID is like in its own category, you know, it's sui generis, but maybe it's not. Like, I'm kind of willing to bet that people want that sort of quick, like close to real time projection and editorial free data in a few different topics as well. And that's a sort of bet that I want to make in the next sort of 12 months, but I don't anticipate that being supported by any individual major mainstream news organization, except possibly The Guardian would be the only ones who would be who would think that sort of way, you know? So yeah.
It depends on the project. But, you know, there's been a long history of like open source and kind of community collaboration with this sort of stuff, which is always good.
Yeah.
Like Open Australia did a lot and have done a lot of very good things. You know, they've kind of brought together volunteers for all sorts of things like transcribing Hansard and like getting developer applications in front of people, making all of that accessible and, you know, lots and lots of things. So, yeah, there's a lot of good work out there done by like volunteers and community groups and all that sort of stuff as well.
Yeah, it's funny that we talk about other forms of journalism as being something that people will just do because, like, you know, it's a big problem, obviously, for funding journalism, but they'll just do, some people will just do it because it's important. And, you know, I thank you, Juliet, for your project earlier on, because I think it was one of those things when it came on, I had been saying for a few days, like, oh, I'm just getting so tired of trying to collate everything across like five different definitions of what COVID is and what a case is and stuff like that. And yeah, it was one of those things where, oh yeah, like brilliantly filled the niche. But yeah, like at the time I was also a little bit like, this is a labor of love. Why would someone do this for nothing? So yeah, I think it's, you know, data journalism is obviously, like many forms of journalism, something that some people, myself included, I've definitely done stuff on, you know, when I'm meant to be on break anyway, we'll do anyway because it's important.
So I noticed some researchers at University of Melbourne spoke with a number of data journalists in 2019 about the evolution of data journalism. And their research stated that there has been a shift from interactive stories where readers can explore stories themselves towards narrative explanatory stories. And that research came out in 2019. So I'm curious if you've noticed a shift since then, or if you agree with that shift from, sorry, exploratory to explanatory. Nick, have you noticed that?
Yeah, I think I know what they're talking about. So, yeah, I mean, certainly earlier on in data journalism, there was a real, like, tendency to just get data sets and do a minimum amount of stuff and put them online, and, you know, make some charts, encourage people to download the actual raw data and then share it. And it was It's kind of interesting. It was like certainly in the early days of the Guardian's data blog, which is actually quite a long time ago now, they would do that sort of thing. And they would actually put up stuff that other people made as well, like real kind of collaborative DIY sort of stuff. And then like the earlier interactives were definitely a bit more exploratory. People would click around and use a lot of drop-down menus and all that sort of thing. And then scrolly telling happened. So like, I don't know if it started with New York Times and Snowfall and whatever that was, but you know, it certainly popularized it a lot. And so now there's like more of a tendency towards like a real sort of guided narrative through the data visualization, when you've got the resources, of course, because it does take a bit more development work to actually do this. So then, yeah, instead of people just finding stuff that they're interested in, they will be guided through the interesting things. But you don't have to do one or the other. You can do both. Like you can have the exploratory bit at the end after you've told people what you think the interesting things are or the important things are, or vice versa. Like sometimes we often will make an interesting map, for example, stick it at the top of the article and say, here's this interesting map, but then we'll have like a bit more of an article below it just to explain some of it and point out interesting things. But yeah, certainly I think that's true, that it has changed a bit over time, and now there is more of a tendency towards like analysis and guiding people through it.
And I mean, Wes, that's part of what you do with creating those explanations, as you mentioned, with the bushfire recovery and creating like a narrative-focused story. Have you noticed that there's a different interest in audiences having that versus more exploratory, here's the data for you to look at?
Yeah, we definitely try and stay away from making stuff too exploratory or making that the only reason we're offering, you know, because if it's a map or something like that, that is a specific form of data, people are most likely to look up their own home and then go away. I think, yeah, we definitely had a bit of a sea change of like a few years ago because, I mean, I think it's been just debunked now, but there was this kind of story that went around that someone had done analysis on New York Times interactives and found that 95% of people or something like that never clicked a tooltip. And so if you're hiding data behind a tooltip or something else, then you're basically not giving people important information. Which I agree with to some extent, and it definitely drives the way a little bit about how we do things. Don't make it hard for people to find the important information. Yeah, so definitely kind of err on the side of storytelling. But yeah, I think there are definitely times when you need, and especially because we're often dealing with research where someone has gone to that minute detail and they have a very specific area of information, knowledge. And what Nick was saying there about doing the storytelling and then taking them to the like the explanatory and then taking them to the exploratory at the end, that's exactly what the Flora Fauna Fire project did. You know, we did all of the like, this is what happened. Here's links to a bunch of stories about individual animals and how they've recovered. And now if you'd like to explore all of the different kinds of birds and frogs and stuff like that have been directly affected, you can, you know, if you're a frog guy, you can read all the frog stories. I think it definitely pays to err on the side of storytelling for most readers personally, but you still have to allow some kind of exploration for those other people.
And I'll end the interview with a nice, big, broad question. But where are we at with data journalism in Australia? And what do you think is the next big step that we'll be taking? Juliet, I'll go to you first.
I reckon COVID has changed a lot of things. I think it's changed people's awareness of data. I mean, I was essentially a digital journalist before COVID, but now I'm comfortable with the term data journalist. But I think I hope people's expectations have changed. Like I'm probably too optimistic in that respect. But for example, there was I mean, I love 730 report, right? So like I'm not throwing shade, but do you remember that there was a story about Victoria and New South Wales being given unfair allocations of Pfizer? And that was a data story, right? Like it's about how much Pfizer is each state getting, and they had it, but it was like, we have this data and we're not showing you the data. And it was, and everyone, and so Twitter sort of went berserk about it because we'd gotten so used to, if you've got the data, show it, right? And if you've made a calculation, show us the calculation. And it was really weird not to have that. So I really hope that the big major step we're taking is towards a sort of radical transparency. Like if you say it's based on data, that, you know, I've got so many examples of this, I could go on and on, but if it says data show, then there's a little hyperlink and you can click on that and see the data without it just saying data show. So yeah, here's hoping.
And Wes, what do you think about the next step for data journalism in Australia?
I think I go into minds of being like a little, as an overall thing, a little bit pessimistic and being like, well, I'm also a cartoonist. So I'm like, there's like eight of us who are employed in Australia in some capacity. And it feels a little bit the same about data journalists, to be honest. So I picked two good areas of journalism to work in. But I think on a grander scale, like I think there is a much better data awareness from journalists. It seems like it's no longer okay to kind of be like, well, I'm a journalist, I don't really do the numbers thing. It's much more integrated. People are much more comfortable, yeah, grabbing the chart to put into their articles and showing that data if they're going to say that, or even just putting it in the para and saying, you know, saying it with some kind of defensibility. And I think that's a really positive thing. It doesn't have to all be big data projects. I think just having better data education for readers, and COVID's probably been a great thing for that. It's also, you know, we've got to iron out some of the nuances, like we were talking about before. People are more interested in seeing the line chart or the, you know, just those simple things. It's always intriguing to me, maybe because I find data interesting and I assume no one else does, that some of our best Instagram posts for the conversation and Twitter posts are a chart, a really simple chart that is, look, the one I was talking about before that's in our style guide, that's simple and we had to do within like half an hour or an hour, and it just goes off. You know, our census stuff, even though we're all covering the census in the last couple of days, our census post has done very well, and, you know, that's great.
And Nick, to you?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with most of that. I think, you know, one of the trends that has also been happening is like, which has touched on a bit, is the mainstreaming of data journalism. So, I mean, for example, with The Guardian UK, they used to maintain the data blog, for example, but now they don't really, because the data stuff is just in normal news categories and or whatever else. And I think that's become more widespread. And certainly with COVID, like as Juliet was saying, you know, we had Casey Briggs on the TV showing line charts all the time, which we never really had before outside of, you know, the economics business segment on the news. So I think that really changed things a bit, and maybe it'll continue. I'm not sure. I mean, Casey did some stuff with the election, so possibly we will see more of that. I mean, I would just like to see, outside of what I think is going to happen, I would love to see more radical transparency, of course. But I'd also like to see people doing more experimental stuff, which is hard given, you know, economic and time pressures. But like, you know, things like that I would really love to work on but can't is stuff like turning data into audio, for example, which would be great for a radio show. And I've had worked on some of this at work, and I've worked on some of it outside of work, because it's like interesting and experimental, but there's no like necessary kind of story that I can then take to my boss and say, oh, you know, here you go, it's the deadline now, here's the thing. It's just all kind of experimental. So I mean, yeah, it'd be great to see more experimental stuff supported and done in some way. And, you know, there's been a kind of increase in sort of grants and philanthropic funding, which I hope will support some stuff like that. But I guess we'll see.
And on that note, I'd like to thank Nick Evershed, Juliet O'Brien, and Wes Mountain for being on Fourth Estate. Thank you all for taking the time out of a very busy census period to chat about data journalism.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media, politics, and a lot in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is FourthEstateAU. Thanks to our executive producer, Anthony Dockrell. I'm Marlene Even. Thanks for listening.